Have you ever waited a very long time for something to happen, and then finally, at long last, it happened, it came to pass? What did you feel like on that day? Sometimes people wait for a long time to get married to that person that they've always dreamed of marrying. Sometimes people wait a long time to get a certain position, to reach a certain level in a career. Sometimes people wait a long time to have a baby or to travel to a destination that they've always wanted to go to. And when that finally happens, it can be the most exciting day of your life. All that anticipation, sometimes anxiety, and then it all comes to a moment. And what a day that is. By the way, sometimes it can be a disappointment. Someone could desire to be a pilot or go up in a plane for the first time, and then when it finally happens, they get sick and throw up all over themselves, and it kind of ruins the experience. But today we're going to look at, in 2 Samuel chapter 5, I've entitled the message, David, King of Israel. And this is the day that he has waited for so long, and finally it comes to pass. Let's read about it in 2 Samuel 5. I want to divide this chapter into five sections. And the first division I want to look at is David's coronation, that it's finally come to pass. He's been king over the southern tribe of Judah, but now finally he is anointed king over all Israel. 2 Samuel 5 and verse 1, it says, "Then came all the tribes of Israel to David unto Hebron, and spake, saying, Behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, thou wast he that leddest out and broughtest in Israel. And the Lord said to thee, Thou shalt feed my people Israel, and thou shalt be a captain over Israel. So all the elders of Israel came to the king to Hebron, and King David made a league with them in Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel." David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. And so David has waited a long time to finally become king over all Israel, and it's finally happening. He was possibly about, we don't know exactly, but possibly about 15 years old when he was anointed the first time by Samuel when he was just a shepherd boy. And now he is 37 years old as he is anointed king over all Israel. It's been more than 20 long years, and a lot of that has been filled with heartache and sorrow. He's been on the run from King Saul, a fugitive. And so, by the way, this is very different from King Saul, who, as you remember, was made king overnight. All of a sudden, Samuel found him and said, "Hey, you're going to be king." And he's thrown into the deep end. It's thrust upon him very quickly that he is the king of Israel. And David has had more than 20 years for that thought that has originally come upon him that he's going to be king, more than 20 years to mature spiritually, to grow physically, to grow mentally, to prepare for all of that. And so it's finally here. Israel here comes to David, and they give three reasons to make him king. We saw that there in verse 1. It says, first of all, they said, "Behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh." They said, "You are related to us. We're all Israelites, and you're an Israelite. Why have we been putting you off to be king for so long? I mean, you're one of us." And so they say, you're bone in our flesh. Number two, they say, "In times past, you are the one that led us out and brought us in." When Saul was the king, David, remember, was a commander in his army. He was a captain over them. And remember that old song, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And David was a great military leader for them. And so they're saying, "We remember what it used to be. I mean, you've been here before with us. You led us out. You brought us in. And so let's make it happen." And then the third reason they give is that God had anointed him. It says, "And the Lord said to thee, thou shalt feed my people Israel, and thou shalt be a captain over Israel." So they come with three reasons. Of the three reasons that they are anointing David, the last is the only one that really matters. If you think about it, it doesn't matter that they are related to him. It doesn't matter that he has a history with them of leading the army into battle. Those are fine things. But that third one, once God says to do something, all other rationalities are mute. And we need to learn how to put that into our lives. In other words, once God said that David's going to be the next king, it doesn't matter whether David had been a leader for them in the past. Once God says he's going to be the king, then Israel should have looked at it that he is going to be the king. And the other things don't really matter at all. Luke chapter 5, verses 4 through 6. Remember that time when Jesus came to Peter and some of the other disciples, and they got to see firsthand, probably for the first time, a miracle that Jesus did. So Luke 5, verse 4, it says, "Now when he had left speaking, he said unto Simon, launch out into the deep, and let down your nets for a draught. And Simon answering said unto him, Master, we have toiled all the night and have taken nothing. Nevertheless, at thy word I will let down the net. And when they had this done, they enclosed a great multitude of fishes, and their net brake." What Peter could have said to Jesus on this day was, "Jesus, let's agree to stay in each other's lane. Okay, you know, you're a good teacher and you do that type of thing. And me, I'm a fisherman. And I won't teach you how to teach and you don't teach me how to fish. This is what I do for a living. I have experience. I have knowledge in fishing. On top of this, we have spent all night fishing and we haven't caught anything. So I can tell you right now, there are just no fish right here. And they're not biting, and you know, that's that." But Peter doesn't do that. He could have said, "I have experience, I have knowledge," but he just looks at the word of Jesus and he says, "Nevertheless, at thy word, I will let down the net." And we as Christians need to learn how to put our own knowledge and our own experience and our own ideas to the side. Once God says something, that's it. Now we just do it. Now it doesn't have to make sense on paper. The masses, popular opinion, they don't have to line up and match up. Once God says to do it, that's it. And that makes the Christian life really simple. It's not always easy. It can be scary to have faith and step out on nothing. But it boils it down very simple. We don't have to figure it all out. We just have to believe God and act on his word. If God tells you to do something, you just do it. If you're waiting for more confirmation, then the devil will often see to it that you don't get more confirmation. We don't need anything more than the word of God. God said, David's going to be king. That should have been enough for Israel. So we see there David's coronation. It finally happens after more than 20 years. He's finally anointed king over all Israel. And let's look at the first thing that he does. Number two, I want to look at David's capital. The first order of business that David sets upon after being anointed king, we see in 2 Samuel 5, verse 6. It says, "And the king and his men went to Jerusalem, unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spake unto David, saying, Except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in hither," thinking David cannot come in hither. "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, the same is the city of David. And David said on that day, Whosoever getteth up to the gutter and smiteth the Jebusites and the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Wherefore they said, The blind and the lame shall not come into the house." So David dwelt in the fort and called it the city of David. And David built round about from Millo and inward. And David went on and grew great. And the Lord God of hosts was with him. So David, first thing out of the gate, they anoint him. He says, "Thank you very much. Now we're going right over here." And it says they came to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites. So Jerusalem goes by a lot of different names. Sometimes we see it in the book of Genesis that it's called Salem. We know it as Jerusalem today, but it was called Jebus in another place in the Bible because the Jebusites lived there. It's been called Salem. Here we see that David calls it the city of David. It's called Zion. It goes by other names in the New Testament, including the book of Revelation. Becomes one of the most famous cities in the world. And David, first thing out of the gate, becoming king, he makes that his capital. He goes and he conquers it. Josephus, I'm going to read a section from the pulpit commentary on this strategy of how they attacked. It says, by the way, in verse 8, David said on that day, "Whosoever getteth up to the gutter and smiteth the Jebusites." What does that mean, to go up to the gutter? Josephus thinks that it was an underground passage or drain. And the view, and by the way, so you go up to the gutter, that sounds, usually you go down to the gutter, but Jerusalem is on a hill, on a mountain. It's about 2,500 feet elevation. And so wherever you are in the area, you always go up to Jerusalem, no matter if you're going north or south. So he says, whoever goes up to the gutter. Josephus thinks that it was an underground passage or drain. And the view of Josephus suggested to him, probably by his knowledge of the way in which the site of Jerusalem is honeycombed by tunnels, has been wonderfully confirmed by the discoveries made by Sir C. Warren, wrote a book called Recovery of Jerusalem. At the northern end of the Pool of Siloam, he found an arched passage gradually narrowing down from a considerable height, till finally there was a passage of only 14 inches high. And as there was a depth of 10 inches of water, there were left but 4 inches of space for breathing. But through this, his men struggled, and at the end of 4 hours' labor, they reached the light of day at the spring called the Virgin's Fount. Beginning here on a subsequent day, they went along in a passage 67 feet in length and came to a perpendicular shaft leading up through the solid stone of the hill. And having scaled this, they next came upon a sloping passage, which finally conducted them to a spot on the hill of Ophel within the fortifications. Joab and a few men may have worked their way and so have effected an entrance into the city, which otherwise was impregnable. It was probably the entrance near the Virgin's Fountain, which they had observed, and David's words mean, "Whosoever will undertake this dangerous enterprise, let him try this underground passage, and when he has entered the fortifications by its means, let him smite the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, because of the boast of the Jebusites that their cripples were a match for his heroes." And so a strategically fortified city, it's a fort that was on this hill of Jebus, of Salem, Jerusalem, and David attacked it. He found a vulnerable spot and they went in there. By the way, it seems here that David is a cruel person and he is abusing blind and lame people. That's not what's happening here. This starts off as a taunt from the Jebusites. David comes and I think he declares his intentions. "I'm king now and we are going to conquer this city and this is going to become our capital." And they say, "Oh no, you're not." And they are looking down from on top of their mountain in their fortified city. And basically they say, "We're so much stronger than you are that even our blind and our lame can keep you out of the city. You could bring your best, you could bring your greatest warriors, just our blind and our lame could keep you out." And I don't think that there were necessarily the blind and the lame involved, but they're just using it as a taunt. Like, even our weakest people could keep you out. And so David says, "Okay, we're going to go, and whoever is guarding it, if it's their blind and their lame, whatever it is, whoever's guarding the city, we're going to go and attack, we're going to invade, and we're going to conquer it." And so this is David's, he sets off on this, and they are victorious, and they conquer this city. So why do you think David chose Jerusalem? He's been there in Hebron. He could have used whatever Saul had for the capital city. Why did he choose Jerusalem? This is a little bit of a guess here. We don't know. But I think that David growing up, by the way, he grew up in the city of, or the town of Bethlehem, which is only about 5 or 6 miles. It's less than 6 miles from Jerusalem. And remember, Jerusalem is a mountain. It's a large hill. Maybe you could call it a mountain. But I think that David growing up, remember, he was a shepherd boy, and he would take the sheep here and there on the hills. And I think he saw that mountain and just always was aware of it. What a high place, the highest place in the area. And there was a fort there, and Jebusites lived there. Now, this is the land of Israel. This is the promised land that God has given to his people Israel. And there are pagan, godless Jebusites living there. And I think David, from the moment that he knew that there were not Israelites living there, he thought, this land, this is given to us by God. Remember when David fought Goliath? It seems so simple. What God has given to us, we're going to take, and nobody can stop God. And I think he looked at Jerusalem and said, God has given this to us. And one of these days, we're going to go and get Jerusalem. And I think from the moment that David had been anointed king as a teenager, he looked at Jerusalem and thought, that'd be a great place for a capital city. And I think he set his mind on it 20 years earlier. And now, as soon as he is anointed king over Israel, he says, all right, we're anointed. Thanks. We're going to Jerusalem. First thing out of the gate. And we're going to go and we're going to capture this for God. Godless heathen people are not going to live in the land that God has given to us. And so he conquers and he sets up his capital. The third division I want to look at in this chapter is, I want to call it David's house. First of all, David becomes king and he gets a capital. And then the next thing that happens is that he gets a house and it is given to him. It is built for him by a man named Hiram. Look at 2 Samuel 5 and verse 11. It says, "And Hiram, king of Tyre," so Tyre is over on the west, on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. "And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David, and cedar trees, and carpenters, and masons, and they built David an house. And David perceived that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake." Now, we don't know much previous to this about this man, Hiram. Potentially, he had just heard what David had just done, about how he went and conquered Jerusalem, and he sees that God is with David. David is powerful, and his exploits are victorious, and maybe he knew, you know, Saul has slain his thousands, and David is 10,000s, and David's a mighty warrior, now he's a king, and he doesn't want to be the next Jerusalem conquered by David, so he sets out to make peace. That's potentially what's happening, but he just volunteers. He shows up with cedars from Lebanon, wonderful wood, and craftsmen, carpenters, and they say, "We want to build you a house, a palace." And so they get right on it. And so David just walks in, and they come, and he doesn't have to build his house. They build it for him. And he takes a step back, and he says, "You know what? All this is the hand of God in my life." What David does not do, he does not say, "Oh, what a lucky break. Isn't that neat? I had saved up this money. Now I can use it for something else. I can go buy a yacht. What a neat coincidence." He doesn't just chalk it up to dumb luck. He says, "You know, God put this on the heart of Hiram to do this for me. And I perceive that God has established me to be king." Remember, David never went and got the kingdom for himself. He had opportunities. He could have slain Saul. He could have slain Abner. He could have slain Ishbosheth. But he doesn't do any of that his own. And when people do slay those people, then he puts them to death if they've done it wrong. Or he distances himself from that. Because he only wanted it to happen in God's way and in God's time. And now he takes a step back and he says, "This is it. God has finally done it. I'm so glad I didn't push through and do it my way and now have regrets." And so David's got a brand new house and he sees that all these things have come together and it's God's doing. We need to make sure that whenever God does things in our lives, that we see his hand And that we don't just, as we said, they don't just say, oh, that's pretty neat. What a lucky day. You know, God is in everything. He is the sovereign of the universe. Nothing happens without his permission, without him doing it. And so when we see that God is there, then we need to take the next step. We need to praise and thank him, and don't just go on like it is. Don't just ignore it and go on like it's something that could just happen every day. Never take these things for granted, because as soon as they've come, they could also go. And so we see David's house. Number four, I want to look at David's family, which is a growing family and getting larger by the day. Read about it in 2 Samuel 5 and verse 13. It says, "And David took him more concubines and wives out of Jerusalem after he was come from Hebron. And there were yet sons and daughters born to David. And these be the names of those that were born unto him in Jerusalem." Remember, we've already listed there were six sons that were born to him in Hebron during those 7 years and 6 months. And now there are more in Jerusalem. And so we go on. Shammua and Shobab and Nathan and Solomon. Ibhar also and Elishua and Nepheg and Japhia and Elishama and Eliada and Eliphelet. And by the way, this is most of the sons that were born. We won't turn there, but in 1 Chronicles 3, I'll read one verse in just a moment. But in 1 Chronicles 3, it gives a list of all David's children. It gives a continuous list from those born in Hebron, as well as those born in Jerusalem. It includes two others that are not mentioned here. Someone named Noga, and then another Eliphelet. We read in Eliphelet, David actually had two sons named Eliphelet. That's a strange name, and he named him twice. Why are these two mentioned in 1 Chronicles 3 and not here? Not sure, but some people believe that they died young, and so they just weren't included. And that potentially could explain maybe David had a son named Eliphelet that died young, and he loved him, so he named another son Eliphelet. So David then has six sons in Hebron, and then 13 more in Jerusalem, and then one daughter, for a total of 20 children. David had 20 children, and that wasn't even all of them, because these were only the children of his wives, if we're going to divide between wives and concubines. There were also others born to his concubines, and we don't know exactly how many concubines David had. We know that he had at least 10. We don't know, he could have had 20. We don't know how many concubines, and we don't know how many sons he had of those concubines. I just want to read the one verse, 1 Chronicles 3 and verse 9. "These were all the sons of David, beside the sons of the concubines, and Tamar their sister." And so, David, we pointed this out in the past, and so we're not going to spend a long time here. But this just shows David's growing, and this is going to lead to the sin with Bathsheba. But David just has a desire for more and more and more women in his life. And you get the idea that as he's reigning, he goes and fights a battle, and everywhere he's going, he says, oh, she's a pretty, bring her in. She can be a wife, she can be a concubine. And this is not God's will. It's direct disobedience to God's command, which he said, when the kings come in, when I set up the kings, they're not to multiply wives. And so we've already looked at this, but this growing desire that David has for more and more women becomes his downfall. But let's leave that and go on as we talk about his family. Which one, by the way, of all these sons that we listed, which one of them was in the line of the Messiah? Most people right away, they think Solomon, and he was, but there were actually two, Solomon and then also Nathan. There were two lines of the Messiah. One is found in Matthew chapter 1, one is found in Luke chapter 3. Matthew chapter 1 is the one that shows Solomon, and that is Joseph's lineage. And then you have Mary's lineage, we believe, in Luke chapter 3, where Nathan is mentioned. It goes David and then Nathan instead of Solomon. So interesting that David was the only person in the line of Christ that had two sons that were in the line of Christ, because the family tree forked and then came back together one day, hundreds of years later, at the marriage of Mary and Joseph and the virgin birth and so forth. I'm going to just read that very quickly in Luke 3:31. It says, which I'm just going to cut into the middle of the genealogy here, which was the son of Malia, which was the son of Menon, which was the son of Mattatha, which was the son of Nathan, which was the son of David. It goes on, which was the son of Jesse and so forth. And so Nathan was also in the line of Christ. Nathan is one of the sons. Now, both of these sons of David are sons of David and Bathsheba, interestingly enough. So that adultery, that adulterous relationship that ended in marriage, that actually produced two sons that were in the line of Christ. So notice here that David named one of his sons with Bathsheba, Nathan. You remember that story? I say remember, it's still to come in 2 Samuel. But if you've heard it before, the story of David and Bathsheba, they sin, they hide it for 9 months, and then Nathan the prophet comes and he points his finger in David's face and he says, "Thou art the man, you are a sinner." He confronts him with his sin, and David says, "I have sinned," and the child dies. Nathan says, the child that is born will die, and the child dies. And David goes on, he has four sons with Bathsheba. One of them's named Solomon, the next one's named Solomon. And one of them is named Nathan. He names his son Nathan after the prophet that confronted him in his sin and told him, your son is going to die. And he names his son after him. You'd think, well, that'd be public enemy number one. You're the guy that came and you're, you know, some people would hold him responsible. You killed my son. And Nathan didn't kill him. God did. But Nathan was the prophet. He was the bearer of that news. But David didn't hold a grudge against Nathan for that. He actually loved him. They had a good relationship. By the way, when David gets very old, it's time to hand it over to Solomon. But Adonijah sets himself up as king. Nathan comes to Bathsheba and says, by the way, have you heard that Adonijah is trying to set himself up and David doesn't know about it? So Bathsheba has a good relationship with Nathan the prophet also. The mother of the child that died, she didn't hold a grudge and bitterness either. And this is very different. This is the exact opposite of King Ahab. So King David, he's confronted with his sin and he repents. And he loves the prophet that confronted him. Here's King Ahab when he is confronted by a prophet. This is the prophet Elijah. 1 Kings 18, verse 17. And it came to pass when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said unto him, art thou he that troubleth Israel? Because he had come in and said, because of the sin of Israel, there's going to be no rain for 3 years unless at my word. Art thou he that troubleth Israel? And he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam. And then three chapters later, he sees him again, 1 Kings 21:20. And Ahab said to Elijah, hast thou found me, O mine enemy? And he answered, I have found thee, because thou hast sold thyself to work evil in the sight of the Lord. What a difference. King Ahab is living in sin. The prophet confronts him and he calls him his enemy. He says, you've troubled our land. Instead of saying, I'm sorry for what I've done. I'm a sinner. I repent. Instead, he takes it out on the prophet. He blames the prophet for the judgment and he is angry at him. How are you whenever someone confronts you with sin? Whenever somebody points out a flaw, you've done this, you're a bad guy, you're a wicked person. What's your attitude toward that, toward correction? If an authority corrects you for something or brings judgment, brings some kind of punishment. Listen to Proverbs 9 and verse 8. Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. There's a difference between Ahab and David. Ahab was a scorner and he hated correction. But David was a wise man, and when he was confronted with his sin, he loved Nathan the prophet. And because of that, he named his own son after him one day. Proverbs 9:9, give instruction to a wise man and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man and he will increase in learning. And so we see a snapshot into some of David's family. Let's go on. Number five, our last thought today, is David's dependence. His dependence on God. He's a brand new king over all of Israel, but he's not too big for his britches. He knows how to depend on God. 2 Samuel 5, verse 17. But when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines came up to seek David. And David heard of it and went down to the hold. The Philistines also came and spread themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them into mine hand?" And the Lord said unto David, "Go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into thine hand." And David came to Baal Perazim, and David smote them there, and said, "The Lord hath broken forth upon mine enemies before me as the breach of waters." Therefore he called the name of that place Baal Perazim. And there they left their images, and David and his men burned them. Notice, really important, they didn't come and take their images and bow down and worship them. They burned them. They got rid of those false gods. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, "Thou shalt not go up, but fetch a compass behind them and come upon them over against the mulberry trees. And let it be, when thou hearest the sound of a going in the tops of the mulberry trees, that then thou shalt bestir thyself, for then shall the Lord go out before thee to smite the hosts of the Philistines." And David did so as the Lord had commanded him, and smote the Philistines from Geba until thou come to Gezer. As David takes over as king over Israel, he doesn't say, "You know what? I've been king for 7 years over Judah, now over all Israel. It's just a step up, but I've been doing this for a while. I'm good at this now. I think I've got it all figured out." He doesn't think that way. The first thing that happens when he is confronted with an enemy is that he stops and he prays. He inquires of the Lord, "God, do you want me to go and fight against this enemy? Are we going to be victorious? Will you deliver them into our hand?" He prays, he inquires of God, because he needs God's direction and wisdom. And we have pointed this out. We actually came to this passage a while ago when we compared it with another passage where David takes a step back and he prays, "God, what do you want me to do?" Remember, we contrasted him with Saul. That Saul, whenever he would pray, God wouldn't answer. But God is answering David. But David here is dependent on God as he takes each step in this new place in life. He's now king over all Israel. And it's kind of scary. It's a daunting order. He's got a lot before him. And so he asks for wisdom. Here David has the humility to see who he was, to see what the task at hand was, and to see who God is. And those three combined are really important. Whenever you go off on a new endeavor, maybe it's a new marriage, maybe it's a new baby, a new responsibility, maybe it's a new job, maybe it's a new house that you're having to pay for. Whenever you embark on a new endeavor, we ought to always see those three things. Number one, there's us. We are weak. Number two, the task at hand is great. Sometimes it's intimidating. I don't know what to do. But then we look at God and we say that God has the wisdom to make up for my lack of wisdom. And he has the power to make up for my lack of power. He has the power to overcome that obstacle. And David looked at himself. He looked at the task at hand. He looked at God. And it drove him to prayer. "I need God. I can't do this on my own." And he prays and God gives him the enablement on that day. This reminds us as well as when his son Solomon took over. Solomon, his reign fell apart later, but he started off really humble, just like his father David. I want to read the passage when Solomon, he's just been anointed king over Israel, and he prays to God one night as God appears to him. 1 Kings 3 and verse 7. It says, "And now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king instead of David my father. And I am but a little child. I know not how to go out or to come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this, thy so great a people? Solomon looks at himself and he says, I'm just a little child. I have no idea what to do. And the task at hand, I mean, these are your people. How could I do this? But then he looks at God and he says, God, you can do this. Give me an understanding heart. Give me the wisdom. And his dependence on God was rewarded in a manifold way. So it's very important here and exemplary for us that David faced the exact same situation twice. Remember, we talked about this before, that the Philistines come against him twice in a row. It seems like the exact same situation, but David sees the need to pray again, to pray every time. He didn't just assume that the second time would be just like the first. And we need to know this in the Christian life, that there are no two situations exactly alike, like snowflakes, like people's faces. There are no two situations that are exactly alike. There's always some wrinkle, maybe just the fact that it's happening later. Something's happened between then and now. Maybe you're different. Maybe the people are different. But every single thing that we face, we need to go to God anew and depend on him anew. Never just assume that you've got it figured out. Oh, I'll just go do what I did last time. Oh, I'll just go do it what he did, what she did. The blueprint's laid. I don't need to pray about it. We need dependence on God. And we have spent time on this in a previous sermon, so we won't belabor it here. But David made a point to inquire of God before he did so many things. Before he goes on this, he inquires of God. What about this? What about that? And maybe in your life, you're tired of hearing that. Maybe you've heard as we've gone through the life of David, we've mentioned it several times. Here he goes again. David inquires of the Lord. Can we move on to some new material? If we are feeling like that, if we're feeling that we're tired of praying and asking God for direction, then we're going to be in a difficult place in life. This is not going to end well for us. Never get tired of people asking you, have you prayed about this? You ever been there where you're about to do something and somebody, maybe your wife, or your husband, or your son or daughter, when it's a child, you know, when it's someone that's under your authority, it can be humiliating. Well, of course I've prayed. Of course I prayed about this. God help me. Yeah, I did pray about that. And so if you get tired of someone ever asking you, have you prayed about this? If you ever pushed back on that because of your pride, you know, we need to be very careful about that. If we get tired of it, it means that we want to be in charge. And we want to run our own lives. And we don't want input from other people. We don't want input from anyone else, even God. And if you can't accept input from God, you can't accept input from anyone. Even the all-knowing and the all-wise God of the whole universe. If he can't speak into our lives and give us input, then who can? If we don't like God's input, then we like garbage. Because all alternatives to God's wisdom and input are trash or refuse. Imagine this. Imagine that you are a volunteer astronaut and you have no clue about space stuff, you know, what goes on in space. And your job is to hop in a rocket and you're going to go along for the ride. And all of a sudden, the pilot gets sick and you got to fill in. You've never done anything in a spaceship before, in a rocket. And now all of a sudden, you're going to have to be the one to get this thing off the ground and to pilot it through space and land it on the moon or land it on some other, you know, to dock it with the International Space Station or land it on Mars. And it's your first day ever. You have no idea. Imagine that's you. And then the person who has written the manual about how to operate the rocket, he built the rocket, he wrote the manual. He comes to you and he says, now, any questions you have, I'm glad to answer. You would say, oh, thank you. What about this? What about that? But imagine that instead of that, you'd say, you know what? I think I'm going to actually call LeBron James, you know, because, you know, I hear that he's more than an athlete. He says he's more than an athlete. And so I'd really like to see what he has to say about how to operate this rocket, because he seems like a really cool guy. And I just really would rather hear from him. I think he's more on my level. He would relate to me better. That would be a foolish and silly thing to do, to deny the one who knows everything about this and to turn to someone who is in your same position. They have no wisdom in this area. That is what we do whenever we don't pray. But we go and we try to get wisdom and information from someone else or somewhere else, or we try to look within. We are denying the answer and we're embracing garbage. We're embracing rubbish. Listen to Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 11. The nation of Israel was walking away from God at this point. It says, "Hath a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which doth not profit. Be astonished, O ye heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid. Be ye very desolate, saith the Lord. For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water." Whenever we turn away from God and embrace anyone or anything else, it's just like this. We need water, and we've turned off the water. We've forsaken the fountain of water, and instead we've made buckets that have holes in them that can't hold any water, and we are never going to get the water that we need. Don't walk away from God. Don't think that you've got life figured out. I've got it by the tail. Oh, I've been here before, or that person has. I'll just do what they did. We need God. We need God more than we know, and our dependence on him will always be rewarded with success. David here starts out his reign. Finally, 20 years of waiting, he's finally anointed king over all Israel. And he starts off with these two acts of dependence on God, and therefore two victories. He defeats the Philistines twice because he depended on God twice. And he got off to a great start in his kingdom because he depended on God. If we will depend on God for everything, then whatever God is capable of is possible in our lives. I'm going to say that one more time. If you will depend on God for everything, then whatever God is capable of, which is everything, that is what is possible in your life. Don't do life on your own. Pray and seek God's guidance and strength, and the sky's the limit. Let's pray together.